Tonight's talk is on the Buddha. The reason why I decided to put this talk on this night is everyone knows that, that today, the 25th of December, is Christmas Day. Now, not many people know that, according to history, that Jesus was certainly not born on the 25th of December. The 25th of December in Rome was a holiday devoted to a god called Mithras. 25th of December was Mithras Day. And all we knew about Mithras in history was that Mithras was a bull. Now, the Romans were not silly people. They were a highly evolved and intelligent civilization. And it was always strange to me why such a civilization would just worship a bull on the 25th of December. But many years later, when I became a monk, and when I started learning a little bit of Pali and Sanskrit, what struck me was Mithras, which really was pronounced Mitra, was a word which I knew from Sanskrit, Mitra, friend, which was so close to the word for Maitreya. And I also realized that there were four animals which the Buddha compared himself to. The lion, who gave the lion's roar, the horse, like the thoroughbred steed, the great elephant, the Naga, and the last animal the Buddha compared himself to, the bull. So I thought that maybe Mithras Day, the 25th of December, some sort of bull, some sort of figure, maybe the 25th of December actually is Maitreya Day. So, my best wishes to you all on Maitreya Day, the Buddha Day, 25th of December, 2003, which is a wonderful day for talking about the Buddha. So this is talking about the Buddha, what the actual Buddha is, and its meaning in our life. Now, many of you will have some understanding of what the Buddha was. But we have to go much deeper to really understand who the Buddha was. There's a saying in the suttas which is extremely powerful and has a very, very deep meaning. It says that the one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. The one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. And other places, if you see the Dhamma, you are a stream winner. Are you a stream winner yet? Have you seen the Dhamma? Do you know the Buddha? So listen to this talk. There may be something about the Buddha you haven't seen yet. Seeing the Buddha means also seeing the Dhamma. Some people say that the Buddha's passed away 2600 years ago. But has the Buddha really passed away? But according to that saying, the one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. And the Dhamma can be seen today. People can become enlightened today. And that's what I've been promising people on this retreat. This is an enlightenment or bust retreat. This is what's on offer here. And if you don't get enlightened, you can always ask for your money back. I shouldn't say that, otherwise I get into trouble with the organizers. But what we mean here is, if enlightenment is possible today, if you can see the Dhamma today, you can see the Buddha today. So is the Buddha really passed away? What do we actually mean by seeing the Buddha? The essence of that attainment of what a Buddha really was, an enlightened one, that enlightenment is what makes a Buddha. And that enlightenment can be seen today. It's an awakening. That's what a Buddha means. An enlightenment. And there's many stories about what that enlightenment really means. Aspects of the Buddha mind. Today in the interviews for the yogis, I've been telling a lot about the story of the Buddha and the raging elephant Nalagiri. Mostly because in my room, where I've been resting, there is a drawing by one of the Sunday school children of Nalagiri, the elephant, and the Buddha. Now, many of you might know that story, but maybe you haven't fully understood its meaning. When Nalagiri, this mad, raging elephant, intoxicated by drink, was sent charging against the Buddha, how did the Buddha deal with that problem? That was a fearful elephant, a dangerous elephant. Did the Buddha run away? No. Did the Buddha fight the elephant? No. He subdued it with loving kindness, with compassion, with the thought, the door of my heart's open to you. Raging elephant, no matter what you ever do, that's called unconditional loving kindness. Even if you pick me up in your trunk and smash me on the ground, even if you trample on me, even if you pierce me with your tusks, I'll still be your friend. It's called unconditional loving kindness. That's how we deal with the raging elephant. Some of the yogis in this retreat have already met Nalagiri. You know what I mean by Nalagiri? It's the raging elephant in their minds who comes fearfully trying to crush you. Oh, I'm not getting jhana yet. Oh, I'm tired. Oh, I'm restless. There are many raging elephants which you can meet every day. Those of you who have come here this evening, maybe you've met the raging elephant of your husband this afternoon. Maybe you've met the raging elephant of your wife. Maybe there's a raging elephant of your boss at work. These are all raging elephants coming charging at you. Now, if you know the Buddha's way, whenever you come across a raging elephant, what should you do? Run away? No. Should you fight? No. You should deal with it with loving kindness, with compassion. Then you can tame the fiercest of raging elephants. Listen to this story from my life as a monk in Australia. After being in Australia maybe 5 years, we moved from a small house where we started to a bigger house. Actually, it was an old Anglican church. The Anglicans were selling their churches. The Buddhists were buying them. So we bought this old Anglican, it was more like a hall than a church, so it suited our purpose very well. And when we painted it, turned it into a nice Buddhist hall with a shrine, we decided to have a grand opening ceremony, like we do in Buddhism. We managed to invite the governor of Western Australia, the Queen's representative in that part of the world, to attend our ceremony. We were so delighted that such an important person had decided to come and grace a Buddhist ceremony, especially in those days when Buddhism was just growing. It wasn't as strong as it is today. Now, as a monk, I'm not just a monk who sits down and does nothing. I work very hard in my monastery. I was given the job of organizing the marquee and the chairs for our visiting guests. Our treasurer told me, it does not matter about the costs. We want to put on a good show. We've got the governor and some politicians coming. This is our big event. Money doesn't matter. We'll get that in donations. So I rang around and I found a hire company which hires out marquees and chairs. The best hire company in the whole of Perth. The sort of company which hired these things out to very rich people in their mansions in the very wealthy suburbs of Perth. I found that company. And I talked to the manager and said, look, we're the Buddhist Society. This is our big event. We really want to put on a wonderful show. Please make sure that we get a very nice marquee and very good chairs. It's important to us. And the manager, a woman, said, yes, I understand. The event was supposed to happen on a Sunday. On a Friday, I was busy helping other people with the arrangements when the truck containing the chairs and a marquee came to our center. The men unloaded the chairs, put up the marquee so quickly that only when it was finished and the workmen had gone did I realize it was already put up. So I quickly went to check, and I couldn't believe it. That marquee was so filthy, it was covered with dust. It must have been in some outback town of Western Australia. But you could clean it up. I got some hoses and we hosed the whole big marquee down. As for the chairs, they too were filthy. But with some volunteers, we got some wet rags and we started wiping those chairs down. Now of those chairs, we had 10 chairs, special chairs, for the VIPs. Not the ordinary chairs, but some very nice chairs. We got the governor of Western Australia coming and his wife. When I checked those chairs, it wasn't that they were dirty, only that their legs were not the same length. Every one of those chairs rocked. Not a little, but a lot. So immediately I rang the phone and I got to the just every time. It was late on a Friday afternoon. I got to the office. I got to the manageress just as she was locking up to go home for the weekend. And I explained to her, do you remember we asked for the very best? Now look, we got a very filthy marquee and chairs, but don't worry about that, we can fix that. But these chairs we got the governor, they rock. We can't have the governor falling off his chair during our ceremony. And the manageress apologized. She said there must be some mistake. And she promised immediately to exchange those chairs. I said thank you, hung up the phone, and waited for the truck to arrive. What I didn't realize is that all the workers of that company had already finished for the weekend. In Australia, such people, when they finish work on a Friday afternoon, they start the weekend's drinking. They were down the pub, already starting to drink lots and lots of beer. When the manageress came in and said, hey guys, back to work, the Buddhists need some chairs. Now such men in a pub on a Friday afternoon are not very compassionate. In fact, they were downright angry that they'd had to go back to work because of some Buddhists. And I found this out because when that truck came towards our temple, some 50 or 60 meters from the temple, while the truck was still going very, very fast, one of the men jumped out of the cabin of the truck and came running towards me with his fist clenched and shouting, where's the bloke in charge? I want the bloke in charge. So I went up to him and said, I'm the bloke in charge. And he came right up to me with his fist, maybe 1 inch from my nose, glaring at me and stinking of alcohol. That's probably the most alcohol I've breathed in ever since I've become a monk. His eyes were wide and red, like these yakka monsters you read about in the Buddhist texts. He was very drunk and extremely angry. His weekend had been ruined because he had to go back to work to exchange these chairs for these Buddhists. I said, I'm the monk in charge. And there he was, staring at me, about to punch me. And what did all my friends and disciples do? Nothing. They just stood there and looked. Thank you, devotees and friends. I think they must have trusted me that I was in charge of the situation. That, to me, was Nalagiri coming to flatten me. That was the raging elephant of an Australian man, drunk, having to go to work when he thought he'd finished for the weekend. And how did the Buddha tame Nalagiri? That's how I tame this man. Not with fear. If I'd have shown even one moment of fear, he would have punched me. He would have hit me, for sure. But I gave him loving kindness, peace, without any fear and loving kindness. It was a marvelous time because he couldn't hit me, nor could he go away. In fact, he didn't need to read his mind to know that he did not know what to do next. There he was, with his fist an inch from my nose. There he was, glaring and breathing alcohol on me. And all I did was be peaceful and give kindness. He'd never seen that before, so he did not know what to do. I actually enjoyed that moment. I had full control of that man. It took about 2 or 3 minutes while I just held him there. He couldn't go back, he couldn't go forward. And he was quite uncomfortable, serve him right. And then, in those 2 or 3 minutes, the truck had parked. The foreman had come out, and he put his hand on that man's shoulder. Come on, we'll unload the chairs. I said, yes, I'll help you. And so we unloaded those chairs together without any problem. Now that's an example of how you deal with raging elephants. That's why we worship that Buddha, for his wisdom. Now, whenever you come across a raging elephant, that's how you should deal with that problem. With compassion and kindness, people can't harm you. Even if a monster comes in, give it loving kindness. It's amazing, just with a Buddha mind, the same mind as the Kalagiri, how any monsters can be completely tamed. Tamed into submission until they completely disappear. Remember the story, one of my favorite stories, of the demon who came into the emperor's palace. Did I tell that story already so far on this retreat? No. The story of the demon who came into the emperor's palace is one of the most meaningful stories that I can find in the Buddhist literature. The story itself is in Udana, but been adapted for modern times by Ajahn Brahm. I've been adapting stories. Now this was a case to the Buddha with Nalagiri, and how you can subdue the fiercest of problems. In this particular case, there was an emperor who had a very wonderful realm. He was a very wise and kind and skillful ruler. But one day, he was out of the palace. I think he was coming to listen to a talk at a temple like Rama. And in his palace, while he was away, a great, ugly, fearsome demon came right into his palace. Now this was a very, very frightening demon. For those of you who have seen demons in the movies, this was much worse than that. This was a very frightening, powerful, gobbly-eyed demon with sharp fangs and a terrible smell. Because he was so terrifying, all the guards and soldiers who were supposed to guard the palace, they froze in horror, giving this demon time to walk right through the palace into the throne room and sit in the chair of the emperor. There was the terrible monster in the emperor's throne. Now at that time, the guards and the soldiers came to their senses. They realized this monster was sitting in their emperor's throne, so they shouted at him, "Get out of there! That's not your chair, that belongs to our emperor." And at those few unkind words, that monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and more offensive in his language. That made them even more upset. They got out their swords, they clenched their fists, they threatened him and said, "Get out of here quickly. If you don't get out quickly, you'll be in big trouble." As usual, as a monk, I can't say everything those guards and soldiers said, because soldiers' language and monks' language are very, very different. But they weren't kind words at all. In fact, they were so full of anger and hatred that demon kept on growing an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more fearful, and more offensive. Now this had been going on a long time by the time the emperor came back from the temple.
If
when the emperor went into his palace, he saw this huge demon taking up more than half of the throne. He was immense. And talk about ugly. Talk about terrifying. Even in the movies, with special effects, you can't get anything as bad as that. That was really terrifying. And his smell would make even maggots go sick. Language was worse than you'd hear in Australia on a Saturday night after being to the pub. It was terrible language. But the emperor was wise. He knew exactly what to do. As soon as he saw this demon, "Welcome. Thank you for coming to visit me. Has anyone got you anything to eat yet? Would you like some noodles with fresh durian from Penang? What can we get for you?" "We can get you a cup of tea. We've got Earl Grey, we've got Lipton's, we've got chamomile, we've got peppermint. What would you like? One lump or two?" And at those few kind words, that demon grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less offensive, less smelly. And at that, all of the guards and soldiers realized their mistake. So they too, instead of threatening that demon and getting angry with him, started to be kind. One of them gave him a foot massage. Why not? It's very rare for a demon to get a foot massage these days, and it made him feel so much better. Another person massaged his neck, because with that big ugly head on his neck, his shoulders would get very, very sore. Someone ordered him a pizza. Somebody got him some noodles. In fact, though every kind act, deed, or even thought, that demon grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less offensive, less smelly. And it didn't take that long, with so many kind acts, kind speech, and kind words, that demon was back to the size when he first came into the palace. But did they stop there? No. They laid on the kindness so much that soon that demon grew so small, so tiny, that one more act of kindness and that demon vanished completely away. That's how they got rid of the demon in the emperor's palace. Because the Buddha said after that story, he said, we call such demons anger-eating demons. Anger-eating demons. If you give them anger, they get bigger, uglier, and more smelly. Do you know anger-eating demons in your life? Sometimes your wife is an anger-eating demon. If you get angry at her, she stands up, she gets uglier, and she... and the language gets worse. Many people are anger-eating demons. That worker who was trying to punch me was an anger-eating demon. Because I didn't give him anger back, he couldn't grow bigger. He couldn't punch me. Nalagiri, the elephant, was an anger-eating demon. If you give them anger, they grow bigger and stronger. Now this is not just people. It's also things in your life are anger-eating. How many sicknesses are anger-eating demons? When you've got a flu, when you've got some malady in your body, even cancer. Imagine the cancer. That's a classic anger-eating demon. This terrible, smelly, offensive thing has come into your body, your throne room. And what do most people say? Get out of here, you don't belong. And what happens? That tumor grows an inch bigger. Less more ugly, more offensive, more of a problem. Why is that? Because every doctor knows that most tumors, or many tumors, are built, they feed on stress. They're anger-eating demons. Imagine if someone had the courage, the guts, to say, tumor, the door of my heart is open to you. I can live with you. I can be at peace with you for the rest of my life. Come in. If you're kind to that tumor, imagine what would happen. It would grow an inch smaller, less ugly, less offensive. And if you give it real kindness, it might even vanish completely away. But you've got to do this properly. It has to be real loving kindness, because some people say they do that and it doesn't work. The tumor hasn't gone away, and I say, I thought you didn't want it to go away. They say, the door of my heart's open to you. I'm kind to you, as long as you get out of here quick. Now that's not how it works. It has to be real kindness, not half-hearted. That also happens to pain as well. Very often pain is an anger-eating demon. I don't like this pain. I don't want this pain. This is my meditation retreat. Why does it have to come now? If you get angry at pain, it becomes an inch bigger, less uglier, harder to bear. So how about doing what the Buddha did to Nalagiri? This raging elephant of pain which is running and charging at you, threatening to kill you. You give it kindness instead. Nice pain. Gentle pain, lovely pain, thank you for coming to visit me. Oh, isn't it wonderful that I have a friend today? Pain. If you can do that, you are not giving anger to one of the great anger-eating demons of the world. Physical pain. You're following a path of a Buddha, of an awakened one, who I said at the beginning of this retreat, went against the stream of the world. Sometimes we call this reverse psychology in modern parlance. It's not reverse psychology, it's seeing things in a different way than most people see it in the world. And solving problems in a way which most people don't expect. We use that in this world. Using another way. Sometimes we have in the Mahayana tradition study about the Buddha that everybody has got Buddha nature. Now, I like the idea of Buddha nature because I've mixed it in different ways. Because if the Buddha means awakened, I say that all the experiences of life have Buddha nature, have the opportunity to awaken you. The man charging towards you, wanting to punch you, it's not the person, but the situation has Buddha nature. The situation has an opportunity to teach you another way of dealing with life, another way of solving a situation, another way of awakening to the truth of life. That's what I like to call Buddha nature. Which is why that my teacher Ajahn Chah, when we were being bitten by those mosquitoes in Thailand, when we went to complain to him, Ajahn Chah, please, can't we get some mosquito repellent? We're only little Westerns. I'm used to this, but we're not. We don't have mosquitoes in England. Please. And he said, no. And he told us, he said, those mosquitoes, don't call them. He said, call those mosquitoes Ajahn Mosquito. They're your teachers. So those mosquitoes soon became Ajahn Mosquitoes. The mosquitoes had Buddha nature in that they could teach me how to awaken. Because you know what happened, those mosquitoes, when they landed on you, you couldn't swat them out, but you could flick them away. But if you flick them away, what would happen? They'd just do a circle and land. Happen, those would bite you again. You flick them away, bite you again. Instead of just one bump, if you were just peaceful, you'd get three itches for the price of one. It was much better to be still and allow them to take a little bit of your blood. It wasn't much. I used to call it giving my blood donations. So, still, big mosquito. These days, some people call their husbands ad bloodspend. You know why? Because they're just like mosquitoes. They're very irritating sometimes. Whatever happens in your life, how about calling Ajahn pain? Ajahn, sickness. Those situations have got Buddha nature. they can teach you something wonderful about life, freedom. Take sickness. Sometimes each one of us will get sick from time to time. But sickness teaches us a lot about how to let go. When you're very, very sick, there you are in hospital. What's the best way to recover? Is to relax. To relax and be at peace with your illness. It teaches you a lot also about kindness, about wisdom. When you go and see someone in hospital, what do you say to them when you go and visit them? You say, how are you feeling today? What a stupid question that is. Please never say that to someone who's sick. How are you feeling today? Because when people ask you that question when you're sick, you're under pressure, under stress, to try and say, oh, I'm feeling a little bit better today, to try and make them happy. How many of you can be absolutely honest to keep your precepts when someone says, how are you feeling today? And you say, awful, terrible. It'd be wonderful if you can do that. At least you're honest. I feel terrible today. But the point is, because someone has been kind enough to visit us, we end up lying and bending the truth. Hands up, how many people in this room have never been sick in their life? Okay, no one's got their hand up. So each one of you has been sick. In other words, it's natural to be sick. It's ordinary. In fact, it would be very, very strange if there was someone in this room who'd never been sick. They would think you're an oddity. They'd think you're weird. In fact, it's so normal to be sick that why is it when you go to see the doctor, you say, doctor, there's something wrong with me. I'm sick. Really, that shows you don't understand the Dharma. You don't understand Buddhism. If you're a Buddhist, if you really understand the teachings of the Buddha, if you've got some ailment, you go see the doctor, you should go and say to the doctor, doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again. Isn't that true? Isn't that sensible? What's wrong with being sick? Now if we say, there's something wrong with me, we're being sick. We're giving anger to the anger-eating demon. We're saying, it shouldn't be this way. There's something gone wrong in life. I shouldn't be sick. Allow yourself to be sick. Make peace with your sickness. Say, the door of my heart is open to being sick. And then you'll get better very quickly. Stress, anger, ill will, those mental states is what causes so much of sickness in our world. How many times have you seen cancers disappearing through meditation? One of the members of our society in Perth, an old Englishman, he was a smoker, so he used to smoke cigarettes. Sure enough, one day he got lung cancer. When he went to see the specialist after going to the ordinary GP, went to see the specialist took an x-ray, showed it to him. His lungs were riddled with cancer, with tumours. Basically, the specialist said, we can try and operate, take something out, give you chemotherapy, radiotherapy, but the chances of extending your life very long are not very much. Basically, you haven't got much to live, long to live. But we can do what we want, what you like. We can try our best. You never know. Go back home, talk it over with your wife, with your family. Come back in 2 weeks, said the specialist. So there is this poor man, having been diagnosed with the very extreme stage of lung cancer, went back to talk with his wife. He sort of came to the decision that, well, just let nature take its course, because having all that therapy, when there wasn't much chance of success, he thought wasn't really worth it. But when he went to his specialist 2 weeks later, the specialist insisted on taking another x-ray first of all, just to see how that cancer had progressed over 2 weeks. When he went into the specialist's room, the specialist was looking at the new x-ray and shaking his head. this English student of mine thought it was much worse than the doctor had thought. He was shaking his head. And so the Englishman asked, "Okay, doctor, tell me straight, how many days?" And all the doctor would say was look up and say, "I can't believe it. The cancer's gone." And he showed him the x-ray 2 weeks earlier. And the cancer, the x-ray taken, sort of, you know, just a couple of hours earlier. The difference could be any, even an untrained person could see. In 2 weeks, lungs riddled with cancer are completely cleared. What have you been doing? Meditation. It's amazing how powerful that can be. But if you meditate to get rid of something, it will not work. It has to be done properly. No stress. The door of my heart's open to whatever's happening. That's the way of the Buddha. Awakening to things. Kindness. Compassion. Isn't that what the Buddha stands for? As a monk, as a Buddhist monk, I always keep in mind what the Buddha stands for. And I try and apply that in every moment, aspect of my life. The Buddha was compassionate, was gentle, was kind. So somebody comes to me, when they say they've broken their precepts, they say they've done some terrible thing, I can't tell them off. I can't shout and scold them, "You stupid Buddhists. You can't even keep your 5 precepts. How many times have you been coming to the temple?" Because that's not how a Buddha would act. A Buddha is compassionate and kind. Keep goodness. That compassion and kindness works much more power than any scolding can ever do. That's why the Buddha was the greatest teacher. Even people would come and try and kill the Buddha. I only got somebody coming to try and punch me. The Buddha got actually assassins. And what did the Buddha do to those assassins? He simply forgave them. Imagine someone coming to kill you. And all you do when they come is say, "Never mind, that's okay. Just don't do it again, you silly boy." And that's sort of what the Buddha did. He said, acknowledge your mistakes. Acknowledge them, don't hide them. Forgive them and learn from them. And the Buddha said that's growth on your spiritual path. There is no need for any punishment. There is no need for hurting yourself even more. Acknowledge, forgive out of compassion and learn. And that's the best possible growth. That's how we grow, and how our children grow, and how everyone else grows in this world. Learning from our mistakes, and not torturing ourselves because of those mistakes. Okay, sometimes people think you should be punished for your mistakes. When I was at school, you get punished for your mistakes. All that taught me was how not to get caught. That's all. I was smart. So when I did something wrong, the teacher never saw it. Punishment just teaches you how to not get caught, that's all. It's like speed cameras. The speed cameras, it just teaches you how to know where all those speed cameras are located. So you speed everywhere else, but you know the places and you slow down in front of the speed cameras, that's all. Because you're not understanding the reason why you should, say, keep the speed limit. Many of you yogis on this retreat, many of you have been going past the speed limit. You've been thinking too fast. In your yogis, going too fast. What happens if you go too fast? If you really go too fast many times, do the police confiscate your driving license so you can't drive anymore? For all of you yogis on this retreat, I hereby confiscate your driving licenses. The driving license of your mind, which has been speeding. So you're not in charge anymore. You can't drive anywhere. You have to stop and go slow. Walk in your meditation. Which means you don't struggle and strive so much. You're kind, you're compassionate, like a Buddhist. What was one of the other great stories of the Buddha? The Buddha and Gaudiyamala. It's another fascinating story which tells you about what the Buddha really was and how he taught. There was Angulimala chasing after the Buddha with another foot, ready to cut off the Buddha's head. And the Buddha had a feat of psychic power. Angulimala was running as fast as he could. It was like running on the spot. He couldn't catch the Buddha who was only walking. So Angulimala turned around and shouted at the Buddha, "Stop, monk, stop!" And the Buddha turned around and said, "I have stopped. Why don't you stop?" And Angulimala thought, "What does he mean? He has stopped. He's still walking. He's not stopped. What does he mean?" And Angulimala was smart enough to understand what that meaning was. What does it mean to stop? It means not present moment. Stop going into the future. Stop the past. Stop all this thinking. Stop all this wanting. Stop all this punishing yourself with guilt. Stop all this complaining. Stop. Can you stop your mind? The Buddha had stopped. When you stop, then you see. You become awake when you stop running through life. How much of life is like running, 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 always on the run to the next appointment, trying to get things done, trying to get things out of the way. Our whole life is running. The only time we rest is when we're dead. Death, so the saying goes in Australia, death is nature's way of telling you to slow down. Death is nature's way of telling you to slow down. When you die, you have to slow down. You have to rest. That's why in cemeteries, what do they put on people's graves? Rest in peace, yeah. It's a bit late then, isn't it? So, here in the meditators, I would like you to get these t-shirts with RIP, rest in peace, now. This is what the Buddha said, stop. Why is it it's so hard to stop? We're always going somewhere. We're always doing something else. One of the great monks in Thailand, it came time for the rains retreat. You know the annual rains retreat? When all the monks spend their time meditating, studying, not traveling around, not working. This monk at the time was building his main hall in his monastery. When it came to the start of the rains retreat, he told all the builders to go home. There'll be no building during the rains retreat period. And so this building was not completed yet. All the workers had gone home. They would come back at the end of the rains retreat. Now this man came to visit this monastery. And they saw that hall and they asked this monk, "When is your hall going to be finished?" And this monk said, "What do you mean, when is my hall going to be finished? My hall is finished." And this lay person couldn't understand the answer. "What do you mean your hall is finished? The roof isn't on. There's no windows. There's no doors. Everything is a mess. There's cement bags and bricks lying everywhere. Are you going to leave it like that? What do you mean your hall is finished?" And this very wise monk replied, "What's done is finished. What's done is finished." And then the monk went back to his hut and meditated. Isn't that a wonderful example of life? What's done is finished. Now you can rest. And that's the only way you can find peace in life. That's the only way you can stop. Can you get everything finished first before you can rest? All of you people who came for this talk tonight, is everything tidy in your house? Are all the dishes washed? Are all the carpets swept, all the beds made, all the washing done? Have you done everything yet? If you tried to get everything done before you come to listen to a Dhamma talk, you would never come. Instead, all you say is, "What's done is finished," and then you can come. Because life is never completed, is it? It's always in the process of completion. There's always more things to be done. However can you take a holiday? However can you take a rest? However can you find peace? Unless you can say, what's done is finished. Take a break. To stop. How can you rest and see how far you've come in life? That's what the Buddha was saying, to stop and see what's happening in the moment. However, I must that story about what's done is finished, because once I told that story in my monastery in Perth, the next day, or actually 2 days later, a Sri Lankan man, a devotee, came to complain to me. He told me that the following night, on a Saturday, his 16-year-old son wanted to go out with his friends. And the father said, have you done your homework yet? And the 16-year-old replied, as Ajahn Brahm says, what's done is finished. See you later. Oh, I got into trouble there. That doesn't apply to homework, but it applies to housework. So do you understand how you can get peace when you say what's done is finished? You can take time off, you can stop. Even executives in the business communities have to learn how to do that. They can never get everything off their desk to have a few moments of peace. And if they don't have those few moments of peace, they get so stressed out, they get heart attacks, they get coronaries, they get so stressed they make wrong decisions. It's important to stop, to be like a Buddha, and every now and again, take time out. What's done is finished. Shh. Now we can rest. So even if it's a sickness, sickness is a marvelous time to stop. You can really relax then. You can be in your bed and enjoy your husband or your wife looking after you. Especially as a monk. People like sick monks. You know why they like sick monks? Because they can do more dana. People love it when I'm sick. Oh, at last, Ajahn Brahm is sick. What can I get you? Now, I remember this one monk, one friend of mine. An American monk. He was visiting his family in Chicago. Now, Chicago is a very, very cold city. This was during the winter time. It was snowing. It was icy. He slipped on the ice and broke his leg. And so he was taken to hospital, put in a hospital ward, with his leg in a plaster. When his mother heard, she raced to the hospital. And he told me, when his mother came into the ward, he never saw his mother smile so much. He couldn't believe it. Mother, why are you smiling? I've just broken my leg. And the mother said, now, son, I've got you exactly where I want you for the next month. The mother could mother the monk, her son. Mothers like doing that, don't they? They like looking after their children who are sick. And those who haven't got any children, you can always adopt a monk. Or if your children are grown up. So there's lots of advantages. So when we're talking about the Buddha, he's awakening. He's using all the so-called problems of life as means for awakening. When we're sick, we can awaken to compassion. When we're sick, we can awaken to the fact we're not in control of our body. When we're sick, we can awaken to the fact this is natural. Allow it to be. We can awaken to the fact that if we really relax, we can say, the door of my heart's open to this. We can relax so much, the sickness doesn't last so long. We can awaken to the Buddha, the wisdom within. Each one of these things becomes our teacher, our Ajahn. Everything in life has got Buddha nature. We learn from everything. Ajahn Chah's story, when he was a young man, he fell in love with a girl from the next village. She loved him too. And they decided to get married. They planned it all. And then one day he found out that their parents, the parents of this girl he loved, and the girl who loved him, and the parents of his best friend had decided that she would get married to his best friend. An arranged marriage. She couldn't do anything about it. He couldn't do anything about it. Even his best friend couldn't do anything about it. That was it. Oh, he suffered so much. They'd fallen in love, but the parents had decided to marry her. Not to any boy, but to his best friend from the village. That was real suffering. But if that hadn't have happened, there would have been no Ajahn Chah. So isn't it wonderful? Such suffering became his teacher and led him off into monastic life. Oh, wasn't that wonderful? So sometimes, what I say that the suffering of life has all got Buddha nature. The worst things in life are where we really learn from. All the terrible experiences, I call them dog poo. Dog poo, smelly. Have you ever stepped in dog poo? It's horrible, isn't it? But if you dig that dog poo into your mango tree or your durian plantation, then when they get those durians, they're especially sweet because of all the dog poo. Dog poo makes very sweet durians. Do you understand the story there? Everything can be used. Everything has Buddha nature. So whatever happens to us in our life, because it has Buddha nature, instead of rejecting it, instead of saying, why is this happening to me? This is unfair. Why am I having such a terrible time in this meditation retreat? Why is everyone else being so happy, but I haven't even started on the first stage of meditation yet? Why is it happening to me? It's because these things are the Buddha coming to call, coming to teach you. This is Buddha nature. And I've found that people who have the hardest time on the path to enlightenment, but eventually reach there, are the ones who have the most wisdom. It's as if they experience, they investigate all the side alleys of the Eightfold Path. They always make mistakes, they do things wrong. That's why they suffer, but at least they know what it's like to suffer. They know all the mistakes on the path. So when they become enlightened, my goodness, they become great teachers. They know the path widely. So those of you who are having a hard time, you may not be the quickest person to become enlightened, but when you get there, you are going to be so wise. So everything has that Buddha nature. All your experiences of life have that Buddha nature. When you get frustrated and depressed, what a wonderful opportunity to awaken to Buddha nature. What do most people do when they get depressed? They get depressed about being depressed. They say, depression, get out of here. Usually what we say when someone is depressed is, what's wrong with being depressed? Does it break any of your precepts? Have you got any precepts which say, I shall refrain from being depressed? I don't know any precepts which says you shouldn't be depressed. So if you're depressed, I say, well done, you're depressed. The Buddha has come to visit you. Depression has got Buddha nature. So what are you doing about it? Learn from it. When you accept these things, when you're at peace with these things, when you're compassionate to these things, like a Buddha would be, then these things don't last very long. Even depression is an anger-eating demon. Get out of there, I don't want to feel depressed. I've seen this many times with the problems of depression in our modern world. People who are depressed, they just want to get out of there. They hate being depressed. They get depressed at being depressed. And depression becomes this spiral going down and down and down and down. The way out of that, if people have got the courage and the guts, is to accept depression. The door of my heart's open to this. If you can do that, be at peace with that depression. You are actually undermining the cause of depression, which is negativity. You're being at peace, accepting. And my goodness, you'll find it will not last all that long. This is the Buddha teaching you to go against the normal ways of the world. Compassion, peace, letting go. That's what the way of the Buddha is. That's what you're awakening to. Awakening to the fact that we make so many of the problems in this world. And we can unmake them in unconventional ways. It's unconventional to say to your enemies, I love you. It's unconventional to face up to a raging elephant and give kindness. It's unconventional to face a person who's about to thump you and just be at peace with them. It's unconventional to accept your sicknesses and be at peace with your cancers. It's unconventional, but it works. You find the freedom from suffering. It's not running away from it. It's not trying to control it. It's letting go. Abandoning craving. Being so content that you make peace. Making peace. Enlightenment is like this house made of bricks. And every brick is one more act of peace. One more act of kindness and compassion. One more act of forgiveness. One more act of letting go. Every brick, every act of what we call good karma. What is karma anyway? But one more step towards enlightenment. One more step towards happiness. One more step towards freedom. That's what good karma actually means in its essence. So you don't get to freedom by creating hatred. You don't get to freedom by creating ill will. You don't get to freedom by making violence to yourself or to the world. You get to freedom in the way of the Buddha. That Buddha tried for 6 years fighting his body, fighting his mind, trying to use violence to create peace. Just before he became enlightened, he saw his mistake. You cannot create peace with such violence to his body and to his mind. So he made peace with his mind. Sitting under a Bodhi tree, developing compassion to the moment, stillness, peace, acceptance, letting go. And all the problems of the world disappeared when he stopped fighting. When he stopped, his mind stopped. When the mind stopped, the world stopped. When the world stopped, suffering stopped. That is what the Dharma is. Stopping. Peace. Calmness. Freedom. Those of you who have stopped in your meditation, when you feel peace and happiness and a sense of freedom, you're getting ever closer to what we really mean by the Buddha, the free one. I've told you in this meditation retreat so far, and those who are coming, one of the great laws of Dhamma is that when you stop struggling and striving in your spiritual path, when instead you allow all of your energy to go into just knowing, mindfulness, attention, the passive part of the mind we call the knower, then that mindfulness grows ever more bright, ever more powerful. Those of you who have experienced those states where the mindfulness is so strong, you can see the leaves on the trees outside, a deeper green, a more beautiful color. When you see the patterns on the marble in front of you become so amazingly beautiful, you're experiencing the mindfulness increasing in its power. You're seeing the mind awakening to the beauty in front of you. The awakening of the mind is getting closer and closer to a Buddha mind, a mind of awakening. It's amazing when you develop the deep meditations, just how powerful your mind becomes and you realize how asleep you've been before. You're getting close to being an awakened one, Some are with strong mindfulness, awake, alert, alive, and also incredibly happy. The Buddha was not just the awakened one, but the happy one. You're coming close to that awakened one, that happy one. When your mindfulness reaches its peak of power and happiness and bliss, then you know the mind of a Buddha. When I first read in the Chula Hatipadopama Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya what the footsteps or the footprints of the Buddha really were, the hairs on the back of my head stood up. If I had any hair on the top of my head, that would have stood up as well. What I read was the footprints of the Buddha do not lie on Adam's Peak or Siripada in Sri Lanka. That's not where you see the footprint of the Buddha. Nor do you see it in Phraputapat in Thailand or the other places in the world which claim to have a footprint of the Buddha. The footprint of the Buddha are four. The first four footprints of the Buddha are the first jhana, the second jhana is footprint number two, third jhana is footprint number three, and fourth footprint is jhana number four. Those are the four footprints of the Buddha. So when you get enough mindfulness, strong mindfulness, still mindfulness, that jhana happens, then you are standing in the footprints of the Buddha. Then you have the mind of a Buddha, Sambodhisukha. There you are meeting the Buddha for the first time. That's according to the suttas, Chula Hatipadopama Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya. So if you want to meet the Buddha, that's where you meet them. Some of my monks have been on pilgrimage to the holy sites in India. I encourage people to go to the holy sites in India, but for those of you who can't afford to go all the way to India, or can't take the time off to go on pilgrimage, or for some other reason are scared of going to India, I give another pilgrimage to the four holy sites of Buddhism. This is that tour in this meditation retreat. I'm taking you on a tour of the four holy sites where the Buddha stood. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, and the fourth jhana. They're the four holy sites. And you don't need a passport. You don't need to get on a plane to go to those places. Those places are right inside you, inside this moment, right here, right now. So, if you ask, people tell you, where did you go in the last 9 days? You said, I wanted a pilgrimage. A pilgrimage to the four Buddhist holy sites. Not in India, but inside of you. And that's where you find the traces of the Buddha. And when you go even deeper and find enlightenment itself, then you come face to face with the Buddha. I don't mean a picture of the Buddha, but the Dharma of the Buddha. When you experience what the Buddha experienced, then there's no difference between your attainment and the Buddha's attainment. You are then an awakened one, alert one, awakened to the truth, and no longer subject to suffering. You too are a compassionate one, a peaceful one, a kind one. That's what the Buddha is. And these are examples of the Buddha's wisdom. These are the examples of the path to enlightenment, the path to solving problems in the world, even the path to becoming a rich man in the world. Some people ask me, what is the secret in Buddhism of becoming rich? And I tell them, work hard, spend little. That's the advice to anyone who wants to become rich in the world. If you want to become rich in the Dhamma, be kind, be generous, be forgiving. And then you'll have the richest heart in the whole of Penang. So, those are some reflections on the Buddha. So thank you for listening on Maitreya Day 2003. Very good. Hope you enjoyed that talk. Some snippets of information. Please don't forget the story of the demon in the emperor's palace. Because there's too many fat demons in the world. And there's too many demons who've been eating anger. We need to give more kindness in the world to have less demons. Okay, now we come to question time. First of all, any questions on the talk which I've just given? From the floor. Going. Gone. Okay, first question. Is sex before marriage a type of sexual misconduct? I don't know why people ask monks these questions. Okay. Is it a type of sexual misconduct? It really depends. It's a very difficult one to answer. If there's a couple who have been committed together, they love each other, and they're basically what I call as a euphemism, test driving before they commit themselves to buy, then maybe it might be okay. But you have to be very careful, because there's a lot of difference between that and between people just what we call like sleeping around and just having sex for the fun of it. It's part of our days now that many people think, oh, there's no problem with this. But look at what happens afterwards. There's a sense of commitment there which isn't really happening, and sometimes that both partners, they feel quite let down afterwards. The best way of understanding whether it's right or whether it's wrong is for those people to feel like afterwards, what have they done? Was it really pure? Was it really good? You don't believe what other people say, because other people in the world are always saying, oh, you should be doing this. This is part of life. Well, what you should really do is, if you have young children, you know, sons and daughters, to actually ask them, well, think about that first of all. Contemplate it. Is it really worthwhile? Do you really want to do that? It doesn't fall under the third precept, though. So you're not breaking the third precept. However, you know, you may be sort of creating a lot of difficulty for yourself. So consider very carefully. Make sure you're not hurting yourself or hurting other people afterwards. What about widowers and widows? Yeah, that's no problem there at all. It's an interesting case. There was a treasurer of our monastery in Thailand. He was the headmaster of the village school, a very highly respected moral person. Every week, even though he had a wife, every week he would go to the local brothel for sex. When we saw that, we said, that's breaking your precept. I mean, you're the headmaster of a village. You know, you come to the monastery every week to keep your 8 precepts. You're wrong. And he said, no, I've talked it over with Ajahn Chah. He said, this is okay, because his wife, she had some mental illness, completely incompetent, couldn't even cook the food. And he had to look after her. She was not really a wife to him. And so Ajahn Chah said, well, if you're a man and that's what you need, you're not breaking your precepts if your wife can't actually supply that to you. So because of that, he was not breaking his precepts when his wife was mentally incompetent because of a disease. So the same about widowers and widows. If they indulge in a sexual relationship with someone other than their spouse, is this breaking the third precept? Yes, that is. If it's, in other words, if one of the partners is married, if they're in a relationship and they sleep with someone outside of that relationship, then that is what is meant by the breaking the third precept. So if there's a relationship, for example, you may be single, but the person you sleep with has got a wife or a husband, then that's breaking your precept. You're breaking up the marriage there. It's the same if it's like underage sex, then that is breaking the precept as well. Because, I mean, people are underage, they might think they know what they're doing, but in truth the matter is they don't know what they're doing. So that's why our laws of our land protect young people from indulging in things and getting into trouble before they really know what's going on. Okay, yeah. Is that okay? But again, the monk is not the expert on such things. So if I made a mistake, please forgive me on that one. Venerable Sir, there's an old lady in the picture here. This old lady, 81 years old, was ill and was also conscious, wanted to sit up and cross her legs 2 hours prior to passing away. Venerable Sir, will be her destination. It's very often that actually happens, that people, especially the meditators, they want to actually, you know, to meditate on the last few minutes of their life. So that sometimes they ask, you know, can I just sit up, can I cross my legs, give me a hand. Because their meditation position, which they're used to, crossing their legs, they want to do that when they are about to die. Which is one of the reasons why if some of you learn also how to meditate when you're sitting on a chair, and you also learn how to meditate when you're lying down, it means that when you're dying, you don't have to have your legs crossed and be sat up to meditate. You can actually meditate where you are. It's a great advantage. You can meditate anywhere. Sometimes I meditate on the aeroplane. And you have much more fun than watching the in-flight movie when you watch the inside movie rather than the in-flight movie. In other words, what's going on inside. It's much better. So if you can learn to meditate in many different positions, then that's very helpful for you. But that particular lady, the very fact that she wanted to sit cross-legged and meditate was obviously her mind was inclining towards Dhamma. There's not much information there, but obviously the chances are that she'd have a very, very good rebirth. Next question. When a person gets into jhana, he loses his 5 sense doors. Isn't it dangerous if the house is on fire and it's in deep jhana? Oh, people think so much, don't they? Now, there was a case very similar to this. In the suttas, there was a monk, or in one of the commentaries, there was a monk who was sitting in deep meditation in the forest. And some villagers came to do hunting or gathering in the forest. And they saw this monk sitting so still, they thought he was dead. So, they decided, because they were Buddhists, they thought it wasn't really proper to allow this dead monk to be eaten by the jungle animals. So they thought it was only right they give him a proper funeral. So they gathered some wood nearby, they were in the forest, they built a pyre, they put him on top and set light to it. And when the fire was well established, they thought, well, they've done everything they need to do now. They're busy people. They had to go and do their own work in the forest, which they did. Now you can imagine their surprise when the next morning that monk walked into their village on arms round. Not even his robes were burnt. It's a strange thing, but they say that if you get into deep meditation, fire can't burn you. You're getting into strange states. There was an Indonesian monk which I met once. He had very strong samadhi. And he told me that he was once meditating in some jungle in Java. And he went into such deep meditation that he was in there for several days. When he came out of his meditation, he actually found that there had been a flood in that jungle. And the water, you could see the water marks, had actually covered him. Even though he'd actually been underwater for I don't know how many days or several hours, it didn't matter to him. He survived with no problem whatsoever. So, if your house is on fire and you get into jhanas, that's probably the best way of escaping damage. Don't worry. Good evening, Ajahn. Good evening. Here in Penang, many people worship Sakadeva Raja. Kindly tell us some interesting stories of Sakadeva Raja. What I need to do so that I may replace him in the future. Somebody's after his job. If he finds out. The sunshine of people of Penang, welcome you here again. Okay. Sakadeva Raja. Saka is just one of the devas. He's a disciple of the Buddha. It's interesting, one of the best stories of Saka is when Saka appeared before the Buddha in, I think, the Indaraja cave. That's around the back of the Vulture's Peak in Rajagaha. And when Saka appeared before the Buddha, this amazing light, a heavenly being, this was supernatural. The Buddha said, hello, welcome, what do you want? And at this, Saka was so impressed. He said, I want to ask him questions, but this is amazing. Whenever I appeared to other ascetics, other people who got deep meditation, all they would do is get excited. Ah, at last I've seen an angel, I've seen a god. And they've asked me their questions, and I haven't had a chance to ask mine. He said, you're the first person, he said to the Buddha, who's number one, not excited when they see a deva. And number two, will listen to me and will allow me to ask my questions. The trouble is with most people these days, if they see anything supernatural, a deva, we think that that deva or that heavenly being is wiser than us. And we ask the deva questions. When people go in trance, we think that that being who's taken over that person must somehow be wise and must know all the answers. And so people, these mediums, these channelers, whatever they say, we believe. These aren't wise beings who take over people. Sometimes they say stupid things. So the point is that just because it's supernatural, we should not believe it, but to test it out to see whether it really makes sense or not. Too many people believe what supernatural, unenlightened beings tell us. So that's one of the stories of Saka, but I don't know why you want to be reborn as Saka. Because Saka is just one of the lower angels. It's much better to worship the Buddha. And don't even worry about being reborn as a human being in your next life. You have this life already. The retreat isn't even over yet. And you're thinking about what, not what you're going to do on Sunday when you leave. You're even thinking what you're going to do in your next life. My goodness. Stay in the present moment, for goodness sake. So that's all I know about Sakadeva Raja. Just one of the beings in those realms. But interesting, do you want to know some more deva stories? I told that deva story the other day about the deva who actually showed this monk into the hall of Wat Bawan in Thailand. Do you want some more deva stories? This is my deva story. Oops. Deva's blowing it away. Now this actually comes from one of the stories of this monk, one of Ajahn Mun's disciples, who, you many of you may have known this story, he was staying in Burma during the Second World War, and because of the danger to monks during the wartime, he decided he'd have to escape and go back to Thailand, but through the jungles, and it was a long, long way, without any villagers, without any food. And this monk had been walking in the jungles between Thailand and Burma for many days. He hadn't seen any villagers. He hadn't had any food. He was so hungry. He was getting weak. He thought he may not make it to Thailand. So he thought to himself, there are devas like Saka. There were heavenly beings who were supposed to help good monks. Why don't they help a good monk like me? I keep the precepts, thought this monk. I meditate. I'm a good monk. I'm just doing my duty. Why doesn't this... My goodness, I think there's a yakka outside moaning. But we give him kindness. So he thought, why didn't the devas help me? Now you may know that story. You may know that story that after he thought that, he just walked a little bit further along in the forest, in the jungle, and there standing in the middle of the jungle, he hadn't seen a village for many, many miles. There was not a village after that for many, many miles. There in the middle of the jungle, on the jungle path, was a well-dressed man, not dressed in jungle rags, but dressed in a sort of clothes you'd see from people in Bangkok, with a tipping can of food, ready to offer to this monk. There were so many strange things in this. How did that person know a monk was coming? Number two, how come he was dressed so finely? And how come that food was prepared, hot, ready for this monk, when there's not a village to be seen anywhere around? The monk accepted that food into his alms bowl. He said later it was the most delicious food, and just enough. But he couldn't help but break one of his customs. He spoke to that donor and asked, "Where have you come from?" And this man, in the middle of the jungle, well dressed with fine food, never said anything, just with his finger pointed upwards. It was a deva had come to feed this monk. Now that's a very well known story. Many of you have heard that before. Now this is my deva story. When I was wandering in the jungles of Thailand, walking in this uninhabited mountain range called Phupan, it wasn't that I wasn't hungry. I'd eaten that morning, but I was very, very thirsty. Never mind. I've got persistence. I was very, very thirsty. And I hadn't seen a well or a village for a long time. See, loving kindness. The power of inviting it into your heart. Now, where was it? So I was very, very thirsty. And I hadn't drunk anything for a long time. When I came to a ridge of a hill, I saw in the valley was a small village. About 5 or 6 houses. I knew Thailand by this time. I knew that in that village, one of those houses would be a small general store, which would sell things like kerosene, sell rice, sell matches, would also sell Pepsi Cola. So I made my resolution. I said, "I'm a good monk. I keep my precepts. I meditate." I said, "If there are such things as devas, the least they can do is make sure I'm given a Pepsi Cola." I wasn't asking for food, I was asking for a Pepsi. So, I walked into that village, a very mindful, restrained monk, with my watching 2 meters in front of me, not looking to the left, not looking to the right. I passed through that village, and I could see that I was right, that there was a general store. I walked right past, no one stopped me. I'd gone about 5 meters past that shop when I heard somebody. I didn't look, I didn't stop, I didn't go faster nor slower. I wanted to test my resolution. 5 meters past the door of that shop, I heard someone running behind me and shouting out the words, "Nimon Krap." Nimon Krap is the Thai words when somebody wants to offer a monk something. Now, I never asked anybody, I never turned round, I never went faster or slower. The person behind me was holding an open bottle of Pepsi Cola. I got my bottle of Pepsi from the devas. However, that could just be a coincidence. Because right behind them, there was another man who was also wanting to offer me a bottle of Pepsi Cola. Then came a woman. Then came another man. In a space of maybe 60 seconds, I had 9 people offering me a bottle of Pepsi Cola each. Not a Fanta, not a Coke, no orange juice, no lemon juice, just the one thing of Pepsi Cola. There was a bench outside that shop. I sat down and I put 9 bottles of Pepsi Cola in front of me. And I thought, these devas, these heavenly beings, they don't mess around. They really wanted to make sure that I knew they were there. Number 9 in Thailand is the lucky number in Thailand. It means like prosperity. When they invite monks anywhere, it's always 9 monks. Those devas were telling me, yes, there are such beings there. The only time I've ever got 9 Pepsis, not even asking for anything. Yeah, there are devas around. And they look after good people. But only if you keep precepts, only if you're good meditators, then they will look after you. And as a monk, you never need to go thirsty. Okay, is that one, Davis? Why did Anatha Pindika remain as a layperson and still fastidious about clean, although he was a stream winner? Clean, that was it. Why did Anatha Pindika still remain as a layperson? Mostly because he still had many duties to be done, and his stream winning. It's interesting that, as far as I understand, that Anatha Pindika, he was one on the path of being a stream winner. In the suttas, they make very little distinction between those on the path of being a stream winner and those actually attained to being a stream winner. Those who, through faith or through wisdom, are doing everything so they actually will become a stream winner at their death. I think that's really what happened to Anatha Pindika. Otherwise, towards the end of his life, there should have been no reason, as this questioner says, that he didn't actually join the Sangha. It seems from the last talk he was given by Venerable Sariputta that much of the Dhamma he didn't really understand until the very, very last moments of his life. So I reckon that Anatha Pindika was only a stream winner at the very end of his life. Because otherwise, why not become a monk or a nun? It's a great lifestyle. I recommend it from experience. Next question, Ajahn. Some people are scared of the karmic consequence of sending their pets to be murdered. What is Ajahn's view? If no intention to harm the pet is meant, is it not an act of compassion to prevent the frequent... It's not to be murdered, it's to be neutered. Okay. If you're neutered, I don't call it neutered. I thought it's murdered on here. I don't call sending your cat to the vet to be neutered. I call it sending your cat to be monasticized. So, what is Ajahn's views about this? There's no intention that a pet is meant to be harmed. It's just an act of compassion to prevent the frequent arrival of new kittens and puppies, which will otherwise be uncared for, sometimes abused, mistreated, or abandoned, or thrown away. Indeed, that the two cats at our monastery were monasticized. So we thought that, well, they're going to be living in a monastery anyway, they should at least be acting like monks or nuns and not having... So there's nothing wrong with that, because that is, in a sense, it's not harming them at all, but it's preventing other problems in society. The more interesting thing is if you have a pet, like a cat or a dog, who is so sick, you take it to a vet, and the vet says it has to be euthanized. And I remember this man who took his big dog, had a big, you know the big Labrador dogs, the really big ones? He took this big dog to the vet, because it had some sort of ear infection. And the dog picked it up, looked at its ear, looked underneath it, and looked all around it, and said, "I'm sorry, the dog will have to be put down." And the other said, "What do you mean put down? It's only got an ear infection." And the vet said, "It's got to be put down because it's too heavy for me to keep holding." That's a joke. Come on. But if the dog really needs to be put down, or the cat really needs to be put down, sometimes it's a very, very difficult thing to do. What would you do in such a situation? Because sometimes if you don't, you know, allow the vet to inject the cat or the dog, then sometimes the vet accuses you of just being harmful and being cruel to that animal. So what I advise people in the West is to ask the animal, ask your cat or your dog whether it wants to be put down, as they said. What I mean there is if you've got a cat and a dog you've had for many, many years, then you'll probably be very sensitive to it. So quietly just pose that question to it and then see what you feel in your heart afterwards. Sometimes, even though that cat or dog is suffering, it would rather live than die naturally, or at least keep going for a few more days, rather than have the injection be put down. But sometimes, you know intuitively that dog or cat has had enough. So ask the cat or ask the dog, ask your pet first of all, and follow your heart. And that's probably the best thing you can do. Is letting go of the beginning stage gaining upeka, equanimity? How could these two be linked? Actually, equanimity, the word upeka literally means looking on. Just looking, just observing. And that's actually what we're supposed to be doing from the very start. Just observing the mind rather than getting involved in what's going on. I know that's your name as well. So you should be very good at meditation. If your name is upeka, no matter what happens in your meditation, good meditation or bad meditation, you should be one who never complains. That's what upeka means, never complaining. So her husband should always tell her, you shouldn't complain, otherwise we're going to change your name. I'm going to try the next question. Here we go. Oh, my goodness. Dear Ajahn, it has been said that bhikkhuni lineage has been broken. What is Ajahn's views on the bhikkhunis? This is my views, that somebody pointed this out, and I think it's true. Monks, a group of five monks can actually ordain a woman as a bhikkhuni. You don't need other bhikkhunis to start the bhikkhuni lineage. That was pointed out to me in the Vinaya. I checked it out myself in the Pali. It seems to be legitimate. I know that most people, the usual way of ordaining a bhikkhuni is having her do an ordination amongst a bhikkhuni sangha, a group of five or more bhikkhunis, and then going to the bhikkhu sangha to have almost like another ordination. However, it's clear that the ordination in front of the other bhikkhunis is almost like a rehearsal, and just an ordination in front of the bhikkhus is enough to call her a bhikkhuni. Now, that really just misses the point. Do women really want to be ordained as bhikkhunis? And the point is that some of the rules which bhikkhunis have to keep are so harsh, and they can't really be changed, that most women do not want to be ordained as bhikkhunis. The women who actually read the Vinaya and actually want to be practicing nuns, the nuns in my monastery, the nuns in Ajahn Sumedho's monastery, having read that Vinaya, decide to go another way. For example, one of the rules for a bhikkhuni is that you can't be alone anywhere. You can't travel alone. It's an important rule. You can't live in a forest. You have to live in town. The rules are so harsh that instead of following that path, what we've done in Perth, what's happening in England and other places in the West, is that we're ordaining women, giving them 10 precepts. And if all the monks kept 10 precepts, it would be a wonderful world. The 10 precepts, they are in the four parisars, which I mentioned the other day. Four parisars, the four assemblies, monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen. Laymen, laywomen, upasikas, upasikas. The nuns or the novices, they fit in to the bhikkhu and bhikkhuni parisars. That's where they fit. And when they keep 10 precepts in the West, we don't call them bhikkhunis, we don't call the monks bhikkhus. We're called monks, they are called nuns. By changing the words, there is no difference in the way that lay people in Australia look at the monks, look at the nuns. They look upon them exactly as equals, and they are given equal status. They've got their own forest monastery. But they still have those 10 precepts, which are the basic precepts from which all other monastic precepts come from. No money, no means of having many possessions. No money means frugality. No power to purchase things in the world. You only get what you're given. So you don't really manage to amass very much if you don't have money. And no sex, nothing to do with sex. Those are the two main precepts of any monk or nun. And sometimes the bhikkhunis or bhikkhus especially, they have all those precepts, but they don't keep them. If every bhikkhu, every bhikkhuni, every nun, novice or whatever, kept those 10 precepts, we'd have very, very strong and inspiring sanghas. To me, that's enough. So this is what we're doing in the Western countries. We are having the 10 preceptors, calling them nuns, calling myself and the other monk monks, and there's a natural equality there, an equality of status. And it gives a freedom from some of those harsh rules which most women sort of think there's no way they can really keep those and live a monastic life in its purity on an equal status with the men. Many people write books about this question. Many people go to conferences and discuss this question. But instead of having all these words, in places like Australia, we're doing something. We're trying something. We're experimenting to see if it works. So far, so good. We have a huge nuns' monastery in the forest, 600 acres, for a nun's sangha to develop. I think it really is the way to go. That's how I feel. So instead of just talking about it, too many people are talking about it, nobody's actually doing very much. So that's what we're doing. Any questions about that? Is that okay? Okay. Dear Ajahn, the meditation we can heal illness. How do we do that? Okay, I've already mentioned that because you relax, because you undo stress, because you undo blockages in the body, a lot of healing happens. I've already mentioned some of the cases of how that healing happens. Those of you, I've mentioned this to several people during the interviews. Sometimes during your meditation, sometimes your body moves, arms jerks, bodies jerks, or sometimes parts of the body get very hot. And a lot of times people say, what's going on? Is this right? Is this wrong? If this happens, you should understand this is usually a very, very good sign. Because of our stress, because we're always controlling, the energies in our body are usually blocked. They never really flow as they should do. When we're meditating, we usually relax so much that sometimes, for the first time, energies can flow freely through our body when we're not paying attention to it. And very often, energies flow to parts of the body which need it. Places which are sick, places which have been injured. And you feel that as a heat spot in your body. It gets very, very hot. And all it is energies of the body going to places which really need it. After a while, the heat disappears. You feel very good in that area. A healing has happened. A balancing of energies. The jerking is when the energies start to flow again. It's gone through the blockage. And there's an opening. In one of my retreats I gave in Sydney some years ago, there was a man who had cancer of the sinuses. He couldn't breathe through his nose. He was always breathing through his mouth all the time. And he said that during one of the meditations, one of the sits, he explained that he heard a pop. He was relaxing so much, and for the first time in I don't know how many months, he could breathe through his nose again. It's amazing just what relaxation does. It allows the body to heal itself. It's like the body is a great self-healer. It's very clever, very smart. If you've got, say, a cut on your finger, all you need to do is to clean it and then put a band-aid on it and leave it. The trouble with most people, they don't know how to leave the body alone. They've got a cut on their finger, they put a band-aid on it. After 5 minutes, they take out the band-aid to see what's happening. And then they put it back on again. Then they think, no. They take it up again, they put some ointment on. They put it back on again. And 5 minutes later, they say, no, that's the wrong ointment. They take off that ointment and put on some other ointment. Because we keep interfering with it, it never heals. If you can just leave the body alone and relax, so often healing happens. Especially in meditation, that's the best relaxation you can do. Especially things like cholesterol, things like heart pressure. It's well known the benefits of meditation in health are huge. One of my monks, before he ordained as a monk, he was an executive in the Power Corporation in Perth. He was always a good Buddhist. He would go and give blood every 3 months or 6 months. As soon as he became a monk, I was with him when we went to give blood in the Red Cross in Perth. When the nurse took his blood pressure, His nurse or the nurse looked at the past records. His blood pressure had gone so far down, she said, hey, there's something going on here. Your blood pressure has gone down. And the nurse looked at him and said, you're a monk. Have you been meditating? He said, yeah, of course. Yeah, that explains it. The nurses knew that if you meditate, it reduces your blood pressure. In fact, many people come to our center in Perth, not because they're Buddhist, because they're referred to our place by the doctors. The doctors tell them, go and meditate at the Buddhist center, because it's well known, it works. So there's so many health benefits from meditation. Dear Ajahn, what is the best sutta to chant daily? Okay, the best sutta is Ajahn Brahm Sutta. Shut up. Be quiet. Or even better than that, I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I love that one. Okay. Now, there's lots of suttas. Whichever sutta or ever short chant, one has good meaning to you, you understand it, you like it, it makes you peaceful, it sort of resonates with you, and that's the one to use. Ajahn, what is consciousness? Where is consciousness? Where is the mind? Is consciousness the same as the mind? I mentioned yesterday, where is the mind? Was it yesterday, a couple of days ago, where the mind is? When I asked you, are you happy, are you sad? And you couldn't point to that happiness or sadness. Then I told you about the biggest thing in the world is the mind. Because everything which can be seen, heard, sensed, known, can all fit into your mind. So the mind is the biggest thing in the world. So that's where the mind is. It's not that the mind is somewhere in the body or somewhere in the world. But the world is in the mind. The whole universe is in the mind. So when the universe disappears, when the universe ends in the big crunch or the big whimper, the mind is still there. If the mind was in the universe, whenever there's a big bang, you'd just be creating minds. When the universe ends, you'd be destroying minds. If the mind was in matter, then the mind would be destroyed, when matter's destroyed. But because the matter is in the mind, because the universe exists within the mind, therefore, when the universe ends, the mind carries on. Many universes arise and pass away in the mind. The Buddha could remember 91 eons, 90 big bangs, 90 crunches. That's called having a good memory. And what is consciousness? The mind consciousness, that part of the mind which knows, the knower, that is consciousness. And you come face to face with that mind, with consciousness, only at the stage of a nimitta. And then you know what consciousness truly is. So, consciousness is the knowing aspect of the mind. Okay, Rubes. Okay, those questions weren't meant to be answered. Here we go. Why do miscarriages happen? My goodness. I recently had a miscarriage, but prior to that I have prayed a lot of mantra every day and transferred merit to my baby, yet it happened. I even released a lot of fishes and frog life and transfer merit to baby, yet the miscarriage. Okay. Sometimes that's the karma of the baby, the karma of the parent, is not quite ripe enough yet. So you gave it a good shot of trying to give that little baby some extra good karma, but obviously it wasn't not enough to make sure that baby got reborn. There was a case in Perth, similar case, some devotees, disciples, when the wife became pregnant with her first child. Everything was going well. I think two or three days before the birth, there was was an ultrasound. Everything was normal, but when she gave birth, the baby had turned in the womb, had wrapped the umbilical cord around its throat, and so was actually stillborn. It wasn't really a miscarriage, but a stillbirth. Now, interestingly, this should really be about rebirth, but I'll put it in now, that there's a custom in some parts of the world, you may do it in Penang, when somebody dies young, at the funeral ceremony, they sometimes put a mark on the body. They put a mark on a body. In Thailand, it was always done with a piece of charcoal. But this couple did it with a biro pen, with a ballpoint. They drew a line on the heel of their dead, stillborn baby. Because they wanted to find out whether this being who tried so hard to come into their life would have another try. They never told me about this at the time. I did the funeral service for this boy. But I know them very well, they wouldn't lie. When I wasn't looking, they got out a pen, and on the heel of their baby, they put a mark. Some months later, the mother became pregnant again. When she gave birth to a child, the child had a birthmark, had a line on its heel. So they were convinced, and there's good reason for being convinced, that that child tried to come in their life once, didn't quite make it, gave it another go, and the second time managed to get into their family. So sometimes that's what happens. Maybe a miscarriage, they're trying very hard, didn't make it first time, but sometimes they make it the next time out. So just not quite enough karma, so he had the miscarriage. Does using mantras during meditation help in any particular way? If yes, are there any suggested mantras? I've already given those two best mantras. Shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up. Well, there's other mantras. Any word which means something to you, just like peace. You're breathing in, peace. Breathing out, peace. Don't use a mantra which is, you know, some Pali or Sanskrit word which you don't understand the meaning of. Do something, it might be in Hokkien, it might be in English, something which means something to you. Keep repeating it again and again, and what happens is that that has an effect on your mind. After a while, you follow those instructions, and you are calm, you are at peace, you do shut up. That's one of the best mantras. Are there any other tools or skills to help one's meditation? Thank you. Yes, one of the best skills is not to think too much. Many years ago, I'm not sure if I told this, I think I told this story in KL. Many years ago, when I was about 6 or 7 years as a monk, when I knew what I was doing, there was another Australian monk in my monastery. On this particular occasion, actually every week we would stay up all night meditating. And usually after staying up all night meditating on the moon nights, we'd go on arms round, have our meal, and after the meal we'd all go and have a rest. Because we hadn't slept for about 36 hours. Everyone was tired. But on this particular occasion, after staying up all night, going on arms round, having the meal, about 10 o'clock, the abbot called this young Australian monk over and said, "Monk, wash my robes." And the monk, the Australian, didn't have any choice. He had all his robes. Even though he was so upset, he said, "Look, I've been awake all night. I've been meditating. Can't you wait till tomorrow? Can't you wait till we have a rest?" "No, wash the robes." So this Australian monk took all these robes to the dying shed. Now, washing robes in Thailand, in the forest monasteries, is not easy. You don't just shove it in a washing machine and press a button. You have to haul the water from the well yourself. There's no pipe water. You have to boil the water. You have to start a fire and boil the water. You use chips from a jackfruit tree and boil out the sap to get something to wash the robes with. And after washing the robes, you have to hang them on the line and be with them all the time, turning them so the dye doesn't run. So it's many hours of hard work to wash robes in Thailand. And this young Australian monk was asked to spend hours of hard work washing the robes when he'd been meditating all night, felt so tired and deserved a rest. He was so upset and angry. You could read it over his face. He was fuming. He was just so upset. So I decided to go and see him. I went over to the dying shed and I saw him there. He was swearing Australian words. And when I saw him, I decided to help him. Not by actually helping him wash. I said, listen, thinking about it is the hard part. Washing is easy. That's what I said to him. I obviously hit the mark because he stopped complaining. He looked at me and then turned around and then started washing the robes. Later on that afternoon, he came to bow to me to say thank you. It was right. It was the thinking about it was the difficult, the painful part. Washing was easy. It was the complaining which was causing the pain, not the washing. Just doing it, that's the easy part. So I always say that that story has a sponsor. Nike, just do it. And that's what I mean about the meditation. Don't think about it, just do it. So that is the advice on how to meditate. Just do it. Stop complaining all the time. Stop thinking, I can't do it. Why do we have to meditate now? Why do we have to meditate when all that noise outside is going on? I thought it was Christmas, peace and goodwill to all humans. Where's the peace? Anyway, next question. Oh my goodness. What is the proper purpose to keep noble silence during meditation retreat? The purpose of noble silence is actually so you don't have to talk. Now other people, if they want to keep noble silence, that's up to them. But you can always keep noble silence. So if they talk to you, you don't need to say, be quiet. Otherwise you've broken your noble silence as well. You remember that story of those four monks meditating, keeping noble silence when one of them sneezed? And the first monk said, bless you. And the second monk said, you've broken your vow of silence. And the third one said, ha ha ha, you so have you. And the fourth one said, I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet. So if someone talks to you and you say, you've broken your vow of silence, that's what happens. So if someone talks to you, just put your finger above your mouth like this. And it reminds them that maybe to talk to other people, but you don't have to talk to you. Now that's only half of noble silence. The other half of noble silence is some people are breaking that rule, they're talking, and you're thinking, why can't they shut up? Why can't they stop the noble, keep the noble silence? This is a terrible retreat. Somebody should say something about this. And you've broken your noble silence inside. Stop complaining. What other people do is their business. What you do is your responsibility. That's their karma. So don't think about other people's actions. Otherwise, you're not silent inside. You've broken your noble silence by thinking and by complaining. So try. Yeah, keep quiet. She's broken his noble silence, so have I. Next question. When we ask others to be silent, somebody else to be silent, does that mean we are not keeping the noble silence? We talk to them, yes. Now just put your finger above your mouth, like that. How to do this in a proper way so that we don't hurt others' feelings? That's how you do it. Finger above the mouth. Don't even say, shh. And people should know that you do not need to talk to them. The other way is get your two hands, take them by the throat, and go, but I wouldn't recommend that. I notice the rates of women to men in retreats and novitiate programs is always a few times. E.g. in this retreat, women outnumber men by 3 times. What is the karmic cause for this? It's because women are 3 times more intelligent than men. True, isn't it? A lot of time it's because the men are doing the work to pay for your retreat. No, they're not. Sometimes that men, they don't really feel that they can be as spiritual. So I think it's important that these days to encourage men to actually to really walk the spiritual path as much as the nuns do. Really, there should be inequality because the spiritual path is talking to the mind, not the body. And the mind hasn't got a gender. That which inside of you, the deepest part of you, your mind, what you come in contact with in meditation, is neither male nor female. So when you meditate, when you talk about the deep truths of religion, then it's really transgender. Doesn't matter whether you're man or woman. That's another thing there. Next question. Venerable, can insights be attained from the first jhana? If can, why have to go through the rest of the jhanas to attain insights leading to nibbana? Yes, you can get insights from the first jhana. You can get enlightened from the first jhana. You can get jhana in this retreat. But most people don't, so they have to come again next time. So this is why, if you're smart, you only have to come once. There's an old story of the five types of horses. The five types of horses are like this. The first horse, when the owner asks it to do something, immediately does it. That's like the yogi. As soon as the teacher tells you what to do, you follow instructions. If you were a horse like that, only one retreat would be enough. You're getting jhanas enlightened all the way. That's the first type of horse. Whatever the instructor says, the driver said, it follows instructions. The second type of horse, the owner has to get out the whip. But when the shadow of the whip falls on the horse's back, it knows what to do. It follows the instructions. That's the second type of horse. Not quite as smart as the first, but still pretty clever. The third type of horse, when the owner gives it instructions and it doesn't follow those instructions, the owner, the driver, has to tap it once, very lightly, just tap, just to remind it what would happen if it doesn't follow instructions next time. And then the horse will follow the instructions. Just needs to tap, that's all. The fourth type of horse, a tap won't work. You have to whack it once. Ow! Ooh! But then it knows, and it follows the instructions. It's just like the yogi who makes a mistake, but only once, and then they learn from their mistake straight away. But the fifth type of horse, you whack it once, it still doesn't know what to do. Whack, 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 and it still doesn't know what to do. That's called a stupid horse. Which horse are you? How many times do you have to suffer in life? How many times have you got to be hit before you realize what the instructions are? And follow those instructions. Please do not be the fifth horse. Whack, 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 whack. How many of you have got sore legs and sore backs? How many times have I told you to sit in a chair, stupid horse? And we hurt, hurt, hurt. How many times have I told you to let go, be kind, be compassionate, be content? And you keep whacking yourself again and again, trying, trying, trying. My God, goodness, there's some stupid old horses in this retreat. Incredible. How could a person get out from jhana immediately? My goodness, they haven't even got into jhana yet. You have to get into a jhana to get out of a jhana. Next question. Does prayer help to alleviate pain in terminally ill persons? If the individual is unable to pray for himself, can others' prayers offer any help? Yeah. So prayers can help. You know, in Perth, I get so many calls on the telephone. We've installed an answer machine. The answer machine goes like this. If you want a prayer, press number one. Press button one. If you want a prayer, press button one. If you want to speak to me, Ajahn Brahm, you haven't got a prayer, so press number one anyway. Isn't that a great answer machine? But prayers actually work. They alleviate a lot of suffering, like the suffering that bloke over there who's screaming in agony and pain. Oh, modern music, it must really suffer to be able to sing like that. So So prayers can help the terminally ill. I think you must be terminally ill as well. No, they do help, because that's actually proven in an experiment which was done in a few universities in the US about a year or two ago. They used people who had AIDS, full-blown AIDS in hospitals receiving treatment. They took a number of Buddhist monks, Catholic priests, Jewish rabbis, and even American Indians, asked them to chant or pray for some names on a piece of paper. Some of those names were just fakes. Some of them were real patients who had AIDS. The people who were being chanted on had no idea that they were receiving chants from monks, from rabbis, from priests. And they asked the doctors, those people who are in this list of people, whether they had better health than expected, the same as expected, or worse progress. And they found that the people who were being chanted on had much, much better progress in their illness than those who did not receive the chanting. And those people being chanted on did not know they were receiving chanting. It was so amazing. I got the original research paper in my room in Perth, but it was so amazing that it got reported in Time magazine. Chanting works, scientifically proved. Could we please order some chanting for that fellow over there so he recovers and he gets healthy soon? My goodness. If a person having critical illness needs to go for an operation to save his life, but will be a vegetable after this, should compassionate Buddhists do this or let him die naturally without the operation? It's up to him to decide, or her to decide. Let people take control of their karma and let our relations support his decision. No matter what he wishes to do, to tell your relation, your mother, your father, your child, please don't worry about us. We give you permission to die if that's what you need to do, or to live. We love you, so we give freedom to you. The door of my heart is open to you, relation who's terminally ill, no matter what you do. So that way we take the pressure off the person making these life and death decisions about their treatment, so they're not so worried about what their family want. Sometimes people make those decisions, they want to live, they're ready to die themselves, but they have to live because their family will not let them die. And that's really a lot of suffering. Sometimes people are ready to die, they should die, but they keep living because their family won't let them go. So please, as a loving family, if one of your relations is ready to go naturally, please send them off with your blessings. Don't think about yourself and your grief. Think about their peace and happiness. They're ready to go, let them go. I think maybe they'd make this the last question this evening. Can Ajahn describe some 32 signs of a great man? My good. The best signs of a great man are they're compassionate, they're peaceful, they're wise, they're moral. Those are my signs of a great man and a great woman. So, are you a great man or a great woman? Are you compassionate to yourself? Are you wise with lots of skillful means to create peace in your life? Are you virtuous? Are you peaceful? If you are, you are a great person. Why did all Buddhist babies' mothers have to die 7 days after giving birth to their babies? I give up. I was not there at the time, so I think I was pass on that one. Okay, so thank you for coming this evening. So there's a couple of questions left, but I'll deal with those tomorrow. When I hope there is some more peace in Penang, I've got to go back to my room and do some desperate chanting for that poor person over there who's in great pain out of compassion for them. So let's share merits to all sentient beings.
Idamenyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idamenyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idamenyatinang hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.